anyone who is a Canadian nationalist has got to feel good about this book, because it's reading BC and Pacific Northwest literature, and yet most of the essays are about Canadian writers.
Well, this is Canada. There we are. I mean, I've brought a long essay in here about Gary Snyder, but it also mentions many of the people that have been influenced by him. I think, you know, there's the Tim McNulty's from the Bill Yeakes that you've got in Washington State. Wonderful writers coming right out of this place. The kind of things they're talking about are what we can be talking about in the Fraser Valley or down in Stanley Park. Blue herons, some of the flora and the fauna. That's one of the hallmarks of writing, I think, from our part of the world here on the West Coast, is that after people like Snyder, writers are expected to know the names of the trees, of, you know, the small mammals, of some of the birds, of the plants. They're not just evergreens, they're not just conifers, you know, that's a spruce, here's how you tell a hemlock from a cedar, these kind of things. What's wrong with that? That was done in Britain for a long time. Look at the great writers like Auden or even the Romantics. They were people that took pride and great pleasure and a certain kind of spiritual solace in their familiarity with the local geography of the place that they lived in. It's there all through Wordsworth. I mean, he became an especially beloved poet in his time, much in the way that maybe Ginsberg became in his time. I think we can use the word beloved, actually, with these people. So I don't know if that's a help in terms of where we're headed with our culture, but I think these writers are doing that. British Columbians, it's nothing wrong with opening up our hearts. There's a reason for that, though, I think. Something took place in Vancouver here that was critical, and it's worth looking at. And I think that it may have something to do with that morphing period where we went away from the American influence of, let's say, the Tisch writers and their mentor, Warren Tolman, and what came after that.
Yeah, a very, very interesting time. And Robin Blazer, of course, you already mentioned, was really at the core of a lot of that. How large a presence does Blazer exert just a couple of years after his death?
Well, I'm not going to say, I didn't know Robin well. I mean, I met him numbers of times, but I didn't study with him, for example. He was a very loved professor at Simon Fraser University. But in some ways, he came from a Parnassian tradition. He was not somebody you went and saw at the local coffee house. He wasn't walking into the classical joint in Gastown very often that I can remember for 20 or 25 years there. He was somebody who, you know, was perhaps a bit more remote than many of the writers in this town. I mean, you'll see George Bowring much more often around town than you would have seen Robin, for example. And it's worth noting that Robin's kind of literary personality, the person who's really keeping it going, is one of the instructors out at UFV, I think Miriam Nichols. She's edited The Fire. She edited the last big edition of The Holy Forest. So she's someone.
And she's working on a biography of him.
I think she is, yeah. And I think she was just living a couple of blocks until recently from where we're sitting here right now. Robin was somebody who breathed a presence into the city, but I would suggest it was probably a very strong intellectual presence. There were other people that were much more action-minded. There were people like Jerry Gilbert, who was around this town for a long time, what were called the downtown poets. They were more populist, perhaps, than Robin was. But his stock is rising. I mean, he did win the Griffin Prize shortly before he passed away. That's a very considerable world tribute.
And at that event, I remember reading a review of it that said even at 80, he was the hippest guy in the room.
Probably the handsomest. There was no question. There was something about, he had that kind of, you know, perhaps something like a Robert Graves presence, to bring another blast from the past name there. That strong personality, a really chiseled personality. Mm-hmm. And reading their work is, you're not going to go away from it unmoved, but it is not light reading. It's a real, you're going to have to roll up your sleeves and get serious about it.
And bring the thesaurus with you, or the OED. You know, you talked a little bit about the influence of San Francisco Bay culture in Vancouver, and of course, Tisch, that's an example of the exchange that was happening with Duncan taking the Greyhound up here, and Jack Spicer and his lectures in Vancouver, very famous. You also say in the introduction to the book that Seattle's an influence as well. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, Seattle was one of the old staging grounds for a long time historically for the Klondike Gold Rush, for the Alaska Gold Rush. it was a natural stopping place. So we've always had something back and forth. I mean, when Jack Kerouac was spending his time drinking at the Blue Moon Tavern in the University District in Seattle there, he was also coming up here to Vancouver and taking a look around this town. We forget that. And one of the people, it may have been something like a Paris Review interview, something of that type, they said, well, what were you doing up there in Vancouver? He says, I was listening to the poets in that city, and there's a young guy up there that's really worth looking at. This guy's serious. Bill Bissett, who's still a shamanic presence in Canadian literary life. So I think, you know, we've been close to Seattle that way. It's been good for us. I think we've, even in the music scene, the grunge kind of tradition that came up here, our bands have gone back and forth and played, and we're the next closest towns to each other. I mean, you know, Calgary's 600 miles away from Vancouver. Victoria is a long ferry ride, but we can jump in our car and we can be down in Seattle in 2.5 hours.
Or the Amtrak. Do you want to speak to, you know, the average American listener or reader who doesn't know what Tish is? Do you want to give us like the minute or 2 minute version of that? That might be a difficult task, but can you try that?
Well, in the late 50s, a young American professor came to teach at the University of BC in Vancouver called Warren Tallman. And he was familiar with Donald Allen, had done work with him on the New American Poetics, this kind of thing. And he began encouraging visits by the new school in American poetry, the Creeleys, the Duncans, the Jack Spicers. These people were now coming to Vancouver, and they made an impact. And this was opposed to the older tradition of people like Dylan Thomas coming here, or the Stephen Spenders, the George Barkers, the British tradition that was influential in university life at that time. The students that came up under the tutelage of Warren Tallman, and there are many, Fred Waugh, I think Jamie Reed, Daphne Marlatt, and George Bowring, and so forth, many of them, Frank Davey, these people were active. They began working with each other, helping each other, working on kind of low-rent publications, getting things going with mimeograph machines, using primitive guerrilla technology to make something happen in a different kind of way than had been done in Vancouver before.
And something happened in a huge way. And it seems to me that, you know, when you look at organic poetry, and that's what Duncan and Levertov called it, you see San Francisco and Vancouver really as the two centers of that way of making a poem in the world.
Well, in Vancouver, we saw some possibilities in these people for a new way of saying things. And one of the things, perhaps, is that it was Pacific Coast. I think we can't get away from that. Versus what was going on in Montreal and Toronto. There were very long established, impressive schools with very fine writers. Louis Dudek. There's no shortage of you know, Archibald Lampman and the Montreal school, or what was going on in Toronto. But suddenly, somehow, that kind of expression that would become 1960s culture was going on in literature, in music, and in the people that were traveling up and down the coast here. I know as a young fellow coming up in the 1960s, that was important. I mean, I made my pilgrimage to San Francisco in 68. It was important to be there. And the first place I went to was City Lights Books. That was the first. I mean, I could have gone to Haight-Ashbury, but there was something I had to do first.
What other qualities do you think are important in the region's most important literature?
What other qualities?
I mean, we talked about Buddhism. We talked about the indigenous thrust. We talked about knowing, having a sense of place and knowing the plants. And I mean, you know, the wilderness here, if you can't let some of that get into your poetry, you're really not alive. Do we miss anything?
I think just the compassion, which is everything else distills into that idea of compassion. It's that compassionate spirit that I think we're trying to bring out here, we're trying to express here, which is cross-cultural and it's intercultural, and it's blurring a lot of those old boundaries. So the compassion, but I think just also that sense of reading close to where we are. We are not having to reach for mentors in New York or in the East somewhere, in Toronto and Montreal or in Europe. We're content these days to read ourselves. There's wonderful writing going on around here. Plenty of it, and it's hard enough to keep up with it. So I think that sense of, well, in Latin we go age quod agis, you know, do what you do, be what you are, and that's what the school here is doing. We're doing what we do, living here, writing about it, writing about the beingness of this place. And I think that the message that's coming out of it is part of that world heartbeat now. It's like world beat in music. Suddenly there's this beat coming out of Cascadia that's emanating, and those ideas are going right around the world.
Do you envision a time when the borders are drawn in a way that owes more to bioregions than 49th parallels?
It's going to take a while. It's going to take a while, but I think some of these ideas are beginning to shape up. Look what's happened in Europe. They've blurred the borders all through there. It's a risky project at the moment, let's say economically, but they made a go at this in Europe. I can remember when the rivers flowing out of Switzerland through Germany were sewers. They looked like sewers. They were revolting to a young North American traveling there in, let's say, 1970. It was appalling what we saw. And suddenly the ideas have caught on. Now, those ideas came from North America. When I say they came from North America, they came from the Pacific coast of North America. It's time to clean things up. It's trying to do better. Now they're catching fish again in the Thames River in London. You go there, it's become charming. Most of the rivers, the Seine is alive again. All through Europe, these ideas have caught on. Boundaries have blurred there. They're trying projects in the Mekong Delta in Southeast Asia. Different countries are trying to work with water sharing, with shared responsibilities. So, you know, in our own way, we're trying that here too. It works in the Great Lakes. Why can't it work here?
Delighted to talk to you. Delighted to see the book, and I wish you continued success.
Thank you.
Trevor Carolyn, editor of Making Waves, Reading BC and Pacific Northwest Literature. It's published by Anvil Press.